All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 686. Jason Lindgren is with me, and for the first time, Eunice Eman is joining us. And this is, well, not exactly a pseudonym. It is a chosen spiritual name. What we're going to do here today is a bit like what Sri Yukteswar did with his book, The Holy Science. The majority of the book is used to show the commonality of the spiritual paths and beliefs of his part of the world in India with what is found in the Bible. And I think these are helpful things in these times. As I say, over and over and over, we are entering a new era, however long it takes us to firmly establish, where we leave behind the idea of service to self, which is what we've been doing forever, and we enter a time of service to others. And in this, in my view, it is very helpful to know things about other parts of the world, which is not to say being urged to adopt them or anything else other than having knowledge of, so that you are, for lack of better terms, not a stranger to other cultures, which may facilitate cooperation, for lack of a terms. But Jason, welcome.
And a hot and humid good morning.
Anything you want to add before we pull Eunice in?
Well, this is definitely going to be from a different perspective than we most of the time look at, so should be interesting.
It is. We're going to touch on the Quran, and there are so many accounts of people who end up seeking the Quran by having read it. I think Cat Stevens' story is actually that, but we'll probably also touch on Sufi and maybe some other things along the way. Anyhow, welcome, Eunice.
Thank you. Thank you, Crow. It's an honor to be here. Thank you very much. Good morning to you all.
So we have a number of ideas that we're going to get through. Is there anything you'd like to offer up before we get in?
No, I'd say just lead the way, and I'll share what I know about this beautiful deen and what this religion and mode of spirituality has to say about our creator, which I think your listeners will find very interesting and probably inspiring as well, if I had to guess.
These are hard topics because, as the Europeans are discovering now, their media has been lying to them about the United States. And it's almost viral right now, the number of Europeans who are simply amazed by what they have found in America, which is completely contrary to what they have been told through their media. This is a similar thing. In America, most of what we hear about Islam is negative. And worse than negative, it is fearful. And that is the majority of what the media in our part of the world tries to portray the Middle East, as we call it. But anyhow, let's jump in here, Jason.
All right. So let's explain to any Western audiences that do not realize that Jesus, Mary, Moses, Abraham, Noah, Joseph, and Solomon are all major figures in the Quran, though they are often presented differently than in the Bible.
So that's to you, Eunice.
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, when I first read the Quran, I was shocked and in a sort of reverent awe of what I was reading, even though it was a translation. And in this religion, translations of the Quran are known to be at least a few steps lower, depending on the translation, than the original Arabic, which has an alchemical sort of transformation of the heart that happens when you actually read and understand the Arabic. So back in 2012, I came across a copy of the Quran translated by a gentleman named Muhammad Marmaduke Pickthall. What a name. But he was an English gentleman who translated the Quran in almost like a Shakespearean type English, very reverent, very sort of royal English. And it really made an impression on me. My first impressions were that it solved, I was having issues, not issues, but just sort of questions and concerns about the so-called problem of evil. Why is evil in the world? Or what is evil? And what is the devil and all that? And the Quran solve that question right away. I don't know if we want to get into this right now, but it sort of disempowered what we call Satan or the devil immediately. And because he was created by God, and God is in control of everything, the Quran makes this very clear. Everything comes from God, creation, all the parameters of existence, our understanding of it, all information, it all comes from the source. But that's including our sort of nemesis, or nemesis, if that's the correct plural word for that, of Satan and the devils.
So let me actually pull us around back to the question. So we've outlined some figures from the Bible that everyone who's Christian are very familiar with. So let's just randomly grab like Noah. How does Noah show up in the Quran. In the Bible, everybody knows that Noah shows up very early on. There's the story of the flood and his lineage. How does Noah show up in the Quran by contrast?
He shows up in different places in the Quran. He also has a chapter of the Quran named after him. The chronology is very similar to the Bible in that he's one of the very early prophets, not far removed from Adam. As far as the particulars of the story, I'd say more details are added. Some of the stuff that happens at the end of the story of Noah in the Bible isn't explicitly refuted by the Quran, but it is implicitly refuted in terms of like Noah, he sort of, once he was off the ark, he was on dry land and had something to drink. And if I'm thinking of the correct biblical account, but there's nothing like that in the Quran. It'd be a good time to note that the Quran makes it clear that prophets aren't capable of serious sin or serious mistakes like that.
The flood narrative is pretty much verbatim.
100%.
Even the animals, like most people, I don't think are aware, they say the animals go two by two. But if you go back and read it, I think it's the clean animals. And actually, I hope I don't get this wrong. It's been so long since I've looked at it. I think it's seven pairs of the clean animals, if I'm not mistaken. And I got to double check that. But all of the bringing of the animals onto the ark, all that is very similar.
Yes, it is. It mentions pairs as well. And there's not a lot of intimate details about what type of animals or where they actually went in the ark or even the dimensions of the ark. What we can deduce from the information in the Quran is that it must have been huge. I think bigger than anything we're seeing on sort of Mount Arafat or any sort of replicas in Kentucky or whatever they have. Because early man, according to the Quran, it's very clear. They were large people. They were what we would term as giants. So as far as what animals were around back then, how large they were, you know, we're talking about like the nuts and bolts of the story and the exactitudes. It must have been a very huge ship because the people were large.
Well, you're bringing up the idea of giants. So in the Quran, is the idea of the flood at all associated with removing the giants?
Well, it is associated with removing a horrible population of people, for the most part. The Quran makes clear that only a handful of people went in the ark with Noah. And it certainly implied and explicitly stated that the elite of his society, as well as the general populace, were all
corrupt.
Corrupt, yes.
And is that because of the giants that they've been corrupted, for lack of a better term? I know there's words that people use to refer to the giants.
I think it's not necessarily because they were giants, but because they had been around so long, and they were sort of arrogant and powerful and everything was going their way for a while. And I think they forgot about God. And this is a theme that's repeated in the Quran. It's like a society or a civilization will be around for a while, as far as historical time goes, and they will either forget about God and get arrogant or get very destructive with regards to their natural surroundings. And this is also implied with the story of Noah, is that they were not only internally corrupt, but they're corrupting the earth as well. And
do they have a name? Do they have a name for that race?
They did not have a specific name for that race. They just call it the people of Noah.
Is there an idea that they were from fallen angels who mated with human women? Is that idea?
There is not that explicit idea. And if we want to just go off to a side tangent very quickly, is that in the Quran, it's very clearly stated that angels are incapable of disobedience to God. So the notion of fallen angels is not in the Quran whatsoever. It's more of the notion of disobedient human beings and disobedient jinn, which is another topic of discussion, which is the other major race of creatures with free will. So jinn have free will, we have free will, and often these societal resets or destructions come from a horrible abuse or misuse of our free will. And as far as the story of Noah goes, that is certainly the case, as stated in the Quran. Also interesting to note, I can't remember, this was mentioned in the Bible, but some of the details the Quran chooses to present are very compelling. And Noah's own son was one of the disbelievers and was drowned. And there's this very dramatic scene in the Quran where Noah's in the ark and calling him to come aboard, or it's already floating or something. And his son's on a mountain and the son's, oh, I'm going to take refuge on this mountain, not coming with you. I still don't believe in you, even though the waters are rising and Noah said this was going to happen.
Which son is this?
I don't know his name. And the name isn't explicitly mentioned. It's just said his son.
Well, you bring up a huge point vis-a-vis the idea of fallen angels, because biblically, the whole idea of Lucifer and all these things are associated with these things. But if I'm not mistaken, in the Quran, angels do not have free will. From the oldest teachings that I have got my hands on, and from people who are much more spiritually adept than I am, their idea and what they have been taught is that angels do not have free will. Yet in the modern kind of Christian, I don't want to call it a culture, but the way Christianity is viewed by the common culture now, there's the idea that they did have free will. The explanation that I have seen is you imagine something having free will and you can't imagine something not having free will. But the ideas that was explained to me is they don't even miss it or want it, because all they do is immediately put into play the directives from the Godhead. They have no desire or never would even consider doing something other than what is perfectly being put forward to, I guess, govern. I don't even know if that's the right word. I guess it's not, but to allow everything to work as it does. And so there's a huge disconnect between the idea for the modern, most modern Christians of fallen angels specifically having free will and the older teachings of not. But let's keep moving along here. Let's go on to the next point.
Explain Sufism as a mystical path within Islam that is focused on direct experience of God rather than political or institutional religion.
Yes. So Sufism is the practical day-to-day living of your life according to the tenets of the Quran and according to the tenets of our inherent human nature, which in Arabic is called the fitra. You might be interested to know that Islamic thought contends that we're born Muslims. And Muslim is just a word, and it means submission to God, submission to the Godhead, submission to the one source of us all. Doesn't necessarily only correspond to the nuts and bolts of the religion itself. It's more of a state of being. I would like to make that clear. So when someone says they're a Muslim, it can either mean, you know, they follow this religion to a T, or they're speaking a little higher mindedly and saying, I submit my will to God, a state of acceptance of what's presented to me in my life. As far as Sufism goes, it tries to live this day to day, basically practicing what is preached in the Quran. And it emphasizes what I would term a personal relationship with our Lord, which is one of the things that excited me about Sufism and Islam in general, is that there's no intermediary necessarily, or I should say there's not even an intermediary that is necessary to interact with God. Sufism states that we are interacting with God all the time, even in the mundane aspects of life. And sort of maybe one might state one of the goals of Sufism is to remove the veils of mundaneness and see the absolute divinity of everything around us, in particular the creation, and in particular our felicitous relations with human beings and other human beings in our family. And it's vast. There's different schools. This is another thing to learn about Islam and Sufism. There's different schools and modes of thought. Some are more conservative, some are more free.
It's a smaller subset of Islam, right? And they're very strict at following the guidelines put forth in the Quran.
This is true, even though a lot of sort of regular Muslims who Sufism is honestly, if I'm being completely forthright, is looked at a bit askance in some Muslim cultures, I should say, and certain parts of the Muslim world, almost synonymous like a hippie, right?
They're looked down on?
A little bit, depending on the culture, depending on how Islam is practiced in a particular region. But then, like I said, there are some more conservative Sufi schools.
So I think most people might be familiar with one of the big Sufi, it's a temple, I assume it's called, in India. It's like on an island and it's covered in gold. And it's kind of amazing the amount of gold that's covering this building, and no one ever tries to touch it. But some of the tenets that I learned about, which were impressive, is they have an open kitchen for absolutely anybody and everybody every single day. And I think there's a version of this in LA, if I'm not mistaken. And that's correct, right? I'm referring to the big golden temple that the Sufis run in India, and it's like on a little island. Do you know what I'm talking about?
You know, I honestly don't know in particular, but it's ringing a bell. But that's certainly one of the tenets of Sufism and of Islam in general is to...
Oh, I'm sorry. It's called the Golden Temple, and it's located in the Punjab in India. A lot of Americans have probably seen it.
I'll definitely look into that and learn more about it. But I should say, I guess it doesn't surprise me that much in that what I've learned thus far about Islam is that helping your fellow man is putting your religion into practice. And if you're not putting your religion into practice, you're kind of not following it fully. So for Sufis to do something like that is a beautiful thing, and certainly within the parameters of the Sufi modes of thought and spirituality. And there are some mentions in the Quran, verses in the Quran that are coming to my mind now, like almost like imagined conversations between someone being fed and someone doing the feeding, and the person who's providing the food to the needy person is saying, I'm not doing this for accolades or anything. I'm doing this for the sake of God, and I see God in you. And for a Sufi to do that, they're almost interacting with God in a certain way. And it's really one of the beautiful things that people would like to learn.
I was a bit surprised to hear that there are parts of Islam that look down on the Sufis. I thought the Sufis had a pretty good reputation. And I hope I'm not mistaken in saying that their kitchens are open for, I think, 2 or 3 meals a day everywhere. I hope I didn't get that wrong. But at the Golden Temple I mentioned, there's a few holy days where there's actually films have been done where they show the number of people there. I mean, it's thousands of, it's incredible the size of the kitchen, the amount of people that have to volunteer, and the sheer multitude of people being fed. It's literally incredible to see.
It really is. And I have seen footage of that, but what I saw was a Sikh temple.
Oh, am I getting that wrong? Let me look it up. I might have gotten that whole thing wrong. Let me check.
It's all good. It's all good. But I don't know as much about the Sikhs, but what I would have to, if I was going to describe the Sikhs to a layman who doesn't know about it, I would say it's almost like a meshing of Hinduism and Islam. In particular, a meshing of Vedanta Hinduism and Sufi Islam.
You said the right words. I totally, it's Sikhism.
Okay.
At the Golden Temple. And so I completely missed the mark on that one. Goes to show how much I need to learn.
Well, it's all good, and I'm glad we straightened that out. But it still stands that the Sikhs, as far as I can tell, are very close to Sufism. I don't know what particulars they adopt of Islam and what they don't adopt. I don't know those particulars, but just by their actions and by some of the things I've learned about them, it's reasonably close to Sufism, that's for sure.
Well, suffice it to say, everything I just said about the feeding and the Golden Temple is the Sikh tradition. And I had it in my mind that there was a relationship to the Sufis. But before I mess that up anymore, let's keep moving.
But there is. There is a relationship. I'll assert there is. It's an implied relationship. And I would have to say that Sufis have a very strong, and both historically and probably currently as well, presence in the Indian subcontinent. And I know they had a huge influence on that population. And I think Sikhism came from that, came from the melding of Hinduism and Islam in India, and Sikhism is the result. And they're not called Sufis, but let me tell you, they're similar. They're similar.
All right, next up.
Please explore the idea that sacred traditions across cultures often describe unseen realms that are populated by intelligences that are beyond ordinary human perception.
Yeah, this is all over the Quran and in the writings of the Sufis, the idea of unseen intelligences. The Quran talks about it almost in every chapter. Now we're talking about the angelic realm and the realm of the jinn, if we're going to sort of simplify and break it down to...
When you say realm, that implies that there's a place that is. So can you more closely define what realm means?
Okay. For me, realm means probably a dimension. I'm talking dimensionality here rather than...
Like the astral plane or something like that.
Correct.
Okay.
The sort of unseen realm that basically beyond our perception as human beings, and a lot of it's beyond our even understanding to even grasp it. And I think it's a larger realm than our current physical realm. And it could be described as infinite, and it is populated by the angelic ranks and the jinn ranks. And if I could speak more about those.
Are the jinn negative and the angels positive?
Definitely. But jinn have the choice. Jinns, I think the majority of them are more trickster negative. it is known and understood that jinn can be believers. There's jinn from all religions. There's Christian jinn, there's Muslim jinn, there's Hindu jinn. There's jinn who are middle of the road, who are sort of neither purely good nor purely evil, just like human beings, except, I mean, the parameters of their existence are quite different than ours. But nevertheless, they're generally thought of as evil, but it'd be inaccurate to state that they're only evil.
Do the jinn play any role in the coverage of King David in the Quran?
More with his son, Solomon. And that's a very interesting story.
But I don't want to jump the gun because we're going to get there.
Sure, sure. But yeah, Solomon and the jinn, there's some very interesting stories in the Quran about that. The Sufis love to talk about Solomon, so he's a very interesting character.
Is there an implied responsibility in the Quran about the relationship of the realm of angels to human beings? Do they have a responsibility or a perceived interaction? And what is that?
Yeah, absolutely they do. And one of my favorite passages, I read it pretty recently in the Quran, was how the angels pray to God for us to be easy on us. It's like the angels are, they're really trying down there, you know, forgive them their sins, guide them upon the straight path.
Like an intercessor?
Kind of, yeah, but almost without our requesting it. They're observers, let me put it that way as well. They're around us whether we know it or like it or not. And they are observing us and writing our deeds, even our thoughts, but they intercede. There's varying grades of angels. And some, like you said before, are like the angels of nature, those that deliver rain and thunder. And like I said, the recording angels, the guardian angels.
So there are guardian angels in Islam.
Absolutely.
You know, this is so interesting. So do you know how many classes of angels there are? I mean, I know that's a pretty in-depth question.
That's true. I'd say I have in my notes 1, 2, 3, 7. No, I'm sorry, 8 ranks of angels. And wow. So there's the highest ones, those that carry the throne of God.
And what are those called?
I don't know the names of those, but the ones below them in Christianity, they're known as the cherubim. And in Arabic, the Mukarrabun, which are those are their near.
Are there seraphim?
There are. Who they correspond to in Islam, I'm not sure. But below the cherubim are the archangels. These are the ones that sort of deliver prophecy. For example, I don't know if your listeners know that the angel that interacted with Muhammad was Gabriel. Gabriel basically delivered the Quran to Muhammad.
Isn't he an archangel?
He is. He's the yes. And as is like Michael and Israfil. Yeah, but Jibril has a huge role in Islam. I said Jibril, that's his Arabic name. So Gabriel, yeah.
It's so interesting how close the information is on the idea of angels in other realms. I've covered a lot of times what some of the secret societies covered way back in the day before they've become as infiltrated and corrupt as they are now. And not necessarily the Freemasons, other branches. And they describe the realms in a very similar way that NASA would describe an orbit. In other words, the angels are closest to us. And the further out you go, which is the planets do the same thing, they supposedly get further away from us. They are almost like in charge of the previous group. And when you get all the way down to angels, they're the most directly connected to us. But the point would be from here to the moon is angels, from the moon to the next body out would be archangels. So they would be at the second level. But if you go all the way out to Saturn, which is the thrones, that's how that realm is described in English, one of the ways. But beyond that are the really high ones that you were just talking about, the cherubim. And if I'm not mistaken, I think the seraphim are above the cherubim. But at that level, it's so close to the Godhead. But what's interesting is the star field is often described way out beyond the idea of Saturn. My point being is that there's a lot of commonality, even when you mentioned 7 or 8 levels of angels. Well, of course, in Christianity, you have to go to mostly sources outside of the biblical canon, I think, but they're very closely defined. So apparently at one time in Christianity, the angels were much better delineated and known about than they currently are now. But it sounds like Islam recognizes very similar names and very similar ideas about where the realms are.
Definitely. And when you just mentioned the 7 ranks, it made me think of the 7 heavens, which are often mentioned in the Quran. The Quran mentions that there's 7 heavens and there's 7 earths, which I am still trying to wrap my head around as far as the layout of our realm here that we are intimately familiar with. But when you mentioned the seven ranks of angels, I was thinking how they could correspond to the seven heavens and who's populating what realm. I should also mention that the guards of hell are also angels. And these are fierce angels. And that's a lower realm, obviously below ours. But
do they have a name?
Yes, they're called Azabania. Azabania.
Do you know what that would be in English?
Oh, that's a good question. You want me to look that up real quick?
You can. And you were raised Catholic, right? When you were coming up?
Yes, indeed.
And Jason, were you raised with any church at all? Did your family choose any branch of religion?
Yeah, I was raised Methodist.
Methodist, that's Protestant, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I was raised Lutheran. That was one of the two things my real mother was allowed to tack on to me when she gave me up for adoption, was that I was supposed to be raised Lutheran, which I was, until I was in my mid-teens doing the whole school, Sunday school thing.
Okay. I don't know enough about like Methodism or Protestantism, other than Martin Luther.
There's a lot of differences, to be fair. I mean, a lot of differences in Christianity and the different branches, which has created the problem that we see where in the modern society, almost everything by authority is used to divide people.
Oh, so much.
Yeah, the religions and how they break down, it's just another tool. Well, it's not meant to be, but it ends up being divisive where people can't see eye to eye because of these things. And I think we're entering an era now where it's time to throw all that away and just recognize that people can choose whatever they want to do. And if they're not harming anyone, then that is fine. And the idea that we're all supposed to judge each other is really the point of doing episodes like this. And when I first saw Sri Yukteswar's book, where he used the first 12 pages to talk about the idea of the Kali Yugas, but the 80% of the rest of the book was literally pulling scripture from the Bible and doing a one-to-one comparison to show that there was a similar, if not verbatim, idea in the spiritual traditions he had been brought up in. And when I read it, I thought, now that's a helpful thing. To me, that promotes understanding, which is kind of the idea I hope comes across here.
For sure. Yeah, the common alien religion, I was what some might term a perennialist before I sort of dove into Islam and Sufism, in that you guys are, I'm sure, familiar with Aldous Huxley and his, I don't know if you've read his book, The Perennial Philosophy. Now, you can say what you will about Aldous Huxley, but I kind of think he was, well, everyone's a mixed bag, right? So I kind of think he really did want to help people sometimes, and sometimes he was doing the agenda of the so-called controllers. And
it's good that you picked up on that. We've done episodes on him. You want to mention anything about Huxley, Jason?
Well, he was certainly dancing in the kind of circles that, for the most part, work against humanity.
I agree. But have you guys read The Perennial Philosophy? It's an amazing book. He's sort of calling from all the traditions and trying to find the commonality in all, just what you were speaking of. And it made a huge impression on me. And it was very, of course, very, very well written and presented from such a sharp mind. But I totally agree that he was in a family that doesn't exactly have the best reputation of benefiting humanity. But
No, by the things that he wrote that end up in our high schools, this is what's kind of shaken out. But they do tell the truth, don't they? It's almost like they put a choice out while they're pushing on the wrong direction and making it a more likely outcome.
That's really, really well put. In all fairness to him, he outlines the commonalities in all the spiritual traditions. When I say all, yeah, he's not including really like animism or like sort of the really primordial sort of so-called primitive religions of like tribal peoples. He's more like the more organized religions and finding the commonality in them in a very compelling and convincing way. Basically implying that it's all coming from the same source, just like we're saying. And like you said, they have to present the truth. You know who I'm talking about when I say they. Otherwise, their plan doesn't have the same power. And the truth has to be mixed up in there. And I think that's one of the things. And I don't know whether he did this out of altruism, out of goodwill, or out of like guilt. Okay, I've sort of programmed with Brave New World, so I have to release. And this is a book I'm talking about, The Perennial Philosophy, that came later in his life as he's an older man. I don't know if he's trying to get some good points with God with writing that book. But anyway, I found it very helpful and didn't seem to me at the time to be working in favor of a centralized control system. It seemed to be more that book of which I speak is in favor of finding a commonality between all the different faiths.
Which in and of itself is not a bad thing.
And yet, based on some of the books that ended up in the mainstream of the country that I'm in, it is crystal clear that he saw the game plan. Otherwise,
for sure.
or the other option there is he's helping frame out how it might work within a storyline, as so many things are done. But let's keep pushing forward, because I want to touch on the sky clock. And this is a crazy, crazy thing. In the Bible, there is precious little that I could consider as directly related to the sky clock. The only one that always jumps to my mind is in the book of Job, where they flat out tell you that the Pleiades have sweet influences, and then they make a statement about who could unloose the belt of Orion, basically, is I think what they're saying. And they go so far as to translate a word, which I think most people agree means zodiac, Maseroth, which nobody knows. And actually, not too long ago, it was not that easy to try to work out what Maseroth would mean beyond people saying, well, we think it means this. But as I've mentioned time and again, there is a cathedral-like church over on the edge of Newport called St. George's, built supposedly at the end of the 1800s, and right in the center of the aisleway, maybe 10 steps from the altar, the zodiac is tiled into the floor. It is my point of view that the sky clock was much more recognized for the influences that we know now that it provides. And when we go back to people like Brahe, who were absolutely coming from an all-inclusive Christian position, he was studying the sky clock the whole time, to the point where I think a lot of what we got from him was censored. But in Islam, well, I'll let Jason tee up the question, Jason.
Please compare the Islamic sky clock concept to other ancient systems where prayer, ritual, and human behavior were synchronized with celestial cycles.
Absolutely, yeah. I should mention very quickly that your mentioning of the sky clock on your shows is what drew me into clicking on your shows to begin with on YouTube, because since I've been intently studying Islam, I've looked at the heavens and the sky as a clock. You know, I didn't use the word sky clock. It's like a heavenly timepiece is what I think I said. And like that really sort of impressed me. And the heavens are mentioned in every chapter in the Quran. It's usually in a quote unquote vague way. The heavens and the earth are often mentioned in conjunction. Heavens and the earth.
Is there any direct mention, like I just mentioned, from the book of Job, where they literally say Pleiades? I think they actually, there may be something about the North Star. I just don't remember at the moment. But
there's something about Sirius specifically mentioned.
So that's the brightest star by a long shot of all the just regular stars.
That is not a planet. Is that correct?
No, it is not a planet. We classify it as a star. And it is in the vicinity of Orion, but it is like literally the brightest star. And by quite a distance, it's bright.
So one of the things the Quran does, it mentions various aspects of God to help us as human beings to better understand God's vastness. And that's one of the things that appealed to me about the Quran, was the so-called the names of God, basically describing or starting to describe the infinite aspects of our Creator. And one of those names is called the Lord of Sirius, and it's definitely referring to the single source creator. So it doesn't go beyond that to say why, but that's one of the beautiful things about the Quran, is that it sort of makes these, dare I say, delicious implications to really sort of coax our minds into sort of contemplating these things on our own so we can grow with this contemplation. So yeah, you mentioned the Lord of Sirius. Yeah.
So that's a very similar concept, what I just heard you say. It implies what actually, can you loose the bands of Orion? In other words, what's written in the stars, no man can rewrite. The idea that God made that and you can't change it at all is a very similar thing that I heard you just say about Sirius. And they're using the brightest star in the sky to put that forward.
Yeah, but it's really interesting in that one of the things that appealed to me about Islam was that the prayer times are delineated by where the sun is in the sky. And so it just tunes you in, by its very nature, a practice to the sky.
So there's sunrise and sunset. I assume there's midday. So what are the other two divisions, if I've got that correct so far?
That's correct. So the first period of time is called Fajr, and that's first morning light to sunrise. So when it starts to get light, but the sun hasn't risen, to the moment sun rises is called Fajr. And from shortly after sunrise to the time of the sun's zenith is called Duhur. That's the Arabic word. From the zenith to, and this is an interesting period of time, and this is calculated by, this it really intunes you in with, you're supposed to calculate the times by observation, even though most Muslims today look at their phone and it has an app that says when to pray. However, we are supposed to use, like, go out and look at
sky clock,
the heavens. Correct. Correct. That's the clock. So anyway, the period after noon, the high noon, the zenith of the sun, to when a object's shadow's length is equal to the object's height. So if I were to go outside at, say, 5 o'clock current time, my shadow would be the same height as my physical body. And that would be what we call Asr. And that's another prayer time.
So that's the third prayer time?
Yes, that is the third prayer time, followed by Maghrib, which is sunset, and then Maghrib to total darkness, to where the light of the sun is completely gone for the time being. That's when night officially begins, and that's another prayer time. So
if you were to, like, roughly put in hours from the apex noon, what we call high noon, where the sun is at its apex, to the third prayer time, roughly how many hours would that be, do you think?
Depending on the time of year. It's longer this time of year. The periods of time in between prayers are longer this time of year. Yeah. So we are looking at from 1 o'clock is the noon prayer here where I live in Illinois to about 5 o'clock. We're looking at 4 hours for our 4 hour period of time. And then 5 o'clock till sunset, which here is 8:30 now. I mean, we just went through solstice, right? So
21st was the solstice, the height of the power of the sun. So actually here on the 23rd, yesterday, in the northern reaches where we live, the longest day occurred on the 21st, and on the 22nd, which was yesterday, the days began to get shorter and the nights longer. But it sounds to me like the prayer divisions are pretty equidistant, roughly about 4 hours apart.
Right. But then in the winter, they're quite condensed in this part of the world.
Because there's less daylight.
Correct. So there's a longer period of time in between prayers in the summer and much less time in the winter hours.
Well, I'd never really thought about that because Ramadan is the month of fasting, and that happens when the days are shorter. So it might make it a little more doable because the length of time you have to wait before you can eat would be less than if it was in the spring or the summer.
Well, check it out. Ramadan and all the Islamic months sort of shift according, and I wrote this down so I could state it clearly.
Oh, I thought it was always near November. That's not true.
No, it shifts because prayers are timed according to the position of the sun and months by the cycles of the moon. Muslims are inherently in tune with the rhythms of the sky clock and nature in general, particularly Sufi.
Well, I mean, does it shift enough to put Ramadan in a spring or a summer month?
Yes, it does. Absolutely. So here we go. I found it. The calendar is a lunar-based. We're on a lunar calendar as Muslims. So it's based on a system of 12 months totaling to 354 or 355 days, causing months to rotate through the seasons over a 32 and a half year cycle. So over 32 and a half years, the months will be shifting. And then after 32 and a half years, it's back to where it originally was. So when I first became a Muslim, Ramadan was in the summer. It was, for lack of a better word, a brutal fast in that it went from like 5 in the morning till, we were living in Arizona at the time, but 5 in the morning to, I don't know what it was.
It'd be almost nine at night in Arizona, probably.
Yes.
So here's the thing. It's amazing. I didn't know what you just told me, but it goes to show how my thinking is. My thinking is still kind of stuck linear because here I am thinking, oh, it just happens around November in my linear idea of the calendar we use. But what's actually going on is it's keeping closely synced to nature. And why is that? Because it's following the luminaries. It's following the sky clock to lay it down. And in the West, so many people are now beginning to realize how important fasting is to your health. And yet that's kind of, maybe it's not one of the pillars, but it is one of the standards in that part of the world for a spiritual path. And there are plenty of people online now that will tell you the importance of fasting vis-a-vis your health.
It changed my life, if I may say so. Something you mentioned just earlier is how you're thinking linearly. It took me, if I just may state, years to wrap my head around why is the month? Because we're raised and taught in such a way that it's hard to break out of that linear way of thinking. And it took me many years to realize, wait, why is Ramadan always shifting? Why is, I don't know why it took me so long to connect it, but it did. And once I got into that rhythm, it was amazing. And then back to fasting, it is so powerful. I don't even know what to say. It's such a game changer, not only for your physical health. I had stomach problems before I started fasting. My stomach problems were, I won't say erased after the first fast, but it seemed like it. It's just a bodily reset, and it's sort of, it's natural tune. Early humans didn't eat all the time. We weren't snackers. We weren't
breakfast eaters. Thanks to Bernays, we're breakfast eaters.
We just weren't, our bodies aren't designed to digest food all the time.
Well, what I noticed about fasting when I first did it, probably 20 years ago, is it is difficult the first time you do it, which is what made me kind of give up some respect when I learned about what goes on in the month of Ramadan. And what I further learned is it's difficult for a day or two or three. I mean, it's difficult for a while, but then something switches and it almost becomes pleasurable.
Yeah.
Like you're in no hurry to break the fast because it's given you energy and clarity and so many things. But then again, it is so easy to get back to the opposite of that. When you're done fasting, it takes nearly no time at all to get used to eating three squares a day. And for me, if I ate three squares, I typically eat one meal a day now, and I might snack or something. But even two meals a day, I'm probably going to be obese. And like Jason, you've kind of done a version of fasting recently, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been using the GLP-3 in combination with just cutting out as much crap as I can.
What's GLP-3? I don't know what that is.
It's a peptide. It works with your body to help you lose weight.
He's lost a third of a person.
Wow, nice.
How do you feel, Jason? Do you notice a major difference in how you feel?
I could definitely notice a difference.
More energy?
A lot of things, yeah. Yeah, and just doing things in general, getting less lethargic and getting up and down, like physically, you can just feel like less stress on your body, especially your knees.
Well, we didn't get far into the notes at the launch here, but we're going to have to break because we're at the top of the first hour. Eunice, is there anything you'd like to add before we take a short break and come back for hour two?
Other than the beauty of fasting, we're just talking about that now. I would like to just mention the psychological interplay that goes on in one's mind during fasting. Cause I don't know, but it's like, oh, I'm calculating the hours until I eat again. It's this battle of the ego. It's a training of the ego, this fasting. And when you're doing it for a month during Ramadan, boy, it is an egolytic where you're destroying the ego. It's a beautiful thing.
Jason, anything you'd like to add?
Well, you're right. We didn't get hardly through any of the points, but that's okay. Plenty of interesting conversation going on. So when we get back, we're going to delve into solar and lunar observations from the Muslim point of view.
Right. And, you know, in the part of the world where I am, and I'll say it again, it really comes into focus with all the Europeans here for the football or soccer match. Go online and look at some of the reactions from all the Europeans who have been consuming their false, lying media like we do here, and just how badly, apparently, America is portrayed. And there are numbers of them that are influencers, as an example, that came to do, you know, drives across America, and all they want to do now is figure out a way to move here. And the things that they have to say about even our food, which kind of surprised me, it brings back into focus just how amazing this place is, seeing this through the eyes of others. But my point here is that where I live, I don't think I've ever, in my recent memory, cannot remember hearing from news a positive word said about Islam. Quite the contrary. I can remember back in the 70s when the idea of terrorism was going to be one of the main go-to fear factors that were thrust out. And where did that occur? Well, it occurred right there in the Middle East, and it has gone on and on. We, Jason and I, covered when the Olympics was the stage that was played out on in the 70s. My point being is it's time to start walking away from this negative, divisive falsehood. And in my view, it's time to learn about other cultures, whether you agree with them or not, so you simply have some understanding to meet human beings as human beings. With that, we're going to take a short break. This is the top of hour one of episode 686. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back for hour two. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. They get access to all the forums, comment sections, where everyone is polite, by the way. They get access to the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon, covering my older lunar telescope work. There's seven lunar waves in that film, among many other things. And you get exclusive access to my current solar work, which has been very difficult this year because when the weather isn't stopping me, the chemtrails are just going wall to wall to wall. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back for hour two. I hope to see you logged in as a member, and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.